You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Laboratory tests are suggesting three doses of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine offer significant protection against the fast-spreading Omicron variant of this virus. Now, this is according to officials at Pfizer. So here today to talk more about the coronavirus and to answer your questions are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, along with Dr. Patrice Burgess, Executive Medical Director at St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center and Chair of the Governor's Vaccine Advisory Task Force. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
Hello. And remember, if you have questions for our medical experts, email us now. Just go to idahomatters@boisestate.edu. So I want to start today with an update about Omicron. Dr. Pate, what is new with this variant nationally and internationally?
Well, there's still a lot we don't know. We are learning more. First of all, with respect to internationally, it has now been identified in at least 57 different countries. With respect to the United States, it's at least in 18, but really when we get to these high numbers, you pretty much expect it's really everywhere. We just haven't detected it because it's in low levels. You know, the big concerns about Omicron are, is it causing more severe disease? Is it more transmissible? And does it get around the immunity caused by infection or vaccines? You know, there's a lot of people saying with respect to the first one that this appears to be causing milder disease. I would tell you that I am quite skeptical of that. It may be, but I'm quite skeptical. I think the reasons why we shouldn't conclude that it's causing milder disease is, number one, we've only identified it the last couple of weeks. And as we've talked repeatedly on this show, it takes time for hospitalizations and deaths to show up. Those are lagging indicators. So that's the first thing. Even with that said, we saw a pretty striking uptick in hospitalizations in South Africa. And of course, one thing that we talked about last week, Gemma, was the report that 11.4% of the admissions were in children under age 2. So that's quite different than what we've seen. I don't know if these are factors that are peculiar to South Africa. They may have a lower threshold for admitting children than we do. I don't really know yet, but it's something that we have to watch. I would also not make a judgment that it's milder disease because the African country is a lot younger than the United States. And we know that COVID tends to be milder in younger people. They have a lower life expectancy. They have a much lower median age. So again, I would just be careful about accepting that this causes milder illness. A lot of people are saying that. I'm just not convinced. There is reason, the second factor, the transmissibility, there is reason to be concerned about increased transmission. Even that is not certain at this point. And there are some reasons that it may be appearing to be more transmissible than it really is at this early point. So I wouldn't be ready to conclude it, but certainly I think there's stronger evidence that it's more transmissible than there is evidence that it causes milder disease. And then with respect to the last point on the immune evasion or ability to get around the immunity from infection or vaccines, certainly it has been concerning that we seem to be seeing a lot of reinfections, people that even had Delta, but now are getting Omicron. So I think it just reemphasizes the point that we've made repeatedly. Even if you've had COVID, you need to get vaccinated and you should do it soon. And then secondly, that we also have seen breakthrough infections. But as you pointed out at the top of the show, Gemma, we had got really good news out of Pfizer indicating that three shots, the full primary series of two shots plus the booster, looks like it may be very protective against Omicron. So that's good news. Last point I would make, it's been really quite alarming to me to hear the anecdotal reports, but quite a few of them, of very large outbreaks in big gatherings, parties and so forth, very high percentages of people that have attended these events getting infected from Omicron. That is quite surprising and would be much more than what we've seen with previous variants. So I think for right now, until we get more information, this isn't the time for big Christmas parties or holiday parties or other kinds of parties just yet.
So, Dr. Burgess, you are on the vaccine task force, the governor's task force. In regard, so knowing now what we're learning about Omicron in regards to it looking like the vaccines can help prevent Omicron, we still have incredibly low vaccine rates here in Idaho. Where are we? What are we seeing? I mean, have we seen an uptick at all in vaccine rates?
Well, in some ways, but not like we would like. You know, the children eligibility, the age dropping, we've certainly seen probably the same folks that got themselves vaccinated bringing their children in to get vaccinated. So we've definitely seen that improvement as that age eligibility went down. But unfortunately, I do think some people are pretty entrenched in whatever concerns they have or feelings they have about the vaccine. And we're doing our very best, you know, to get information out to help people have what they need to make a good choice for themselves and their families. We have always emphasized that we know there will be new variants coming along and that the vaccine might not be 100% perfect. No vaccine's 100% perfect, but being vaccinated definitely has been shown without a doubt to help prevent serious illness, even from the new variants like the Delta variant. And as Dr. Pate said, very good news that vaccine boosters are assisting in keeping people from getting sick from the Omicron variant. And again, keeping people from being seriously ill, out of the hospital, from dying from COVID, and also protecting our vulnerable population by being less likely to get seriously ill. We know when people are seriously ill, they're spreading the virus more easily. And so the more we can reduce that, the better we can protect our population, but not seeing it as much of a bump as we would like.
Mm-hmm. There was, I think, just a heartbreaking story in the Idaho Capital Sun yesterday. This is about a gentleman who was vaccinated. He always wore his mask, according to his wife. He got COVID, and he died after 3 weeks in the hospital. Dr. Pate, can we talk a little bit about this? I mean, you said just moments ago about, you know, we're hearing these anecdotal stories. And I know that this doesn't happen a lot where someone is vaccinated. And not only do they get COVID, but then they are hospitalized and they die from it. But here is someone who was doing the right thing all of the time.
Yeah, I saw that story and it is heartbreaking. And I wish that was the only story like that Dr. Burgess or I have heard. And I think this just goes back to the point that our discussion in Idaho and across the country, and in fact, across the world, has really been the wrong one. It's about these individual rights. I want to be able to do what I want to be able to do. And of course, one of the things that we cherish about our country is that we have many, many rights. But where we are strong as a nation is when we come together, and especially when we come together to protect the most vulnerable among us. This is not a new concept. We have many laws, many restrictions that are intended to say there are certain activities that you're going to pose so much threat to somebody else that you can't do that. And, you know, notably, if you want to drink at home, then you can do that. That's your right. But it becomes a different matter when you get behind the wheel of a car. And so same thing here. I think what is very aggravating is for some individuals like this gentleman to be doing the very best he can, wearing masks, being very careful about where he and his wife go, limiting their contacts, getting fully vaccinated, and getting boosted. Now, in his case, he had an underlying immunodeficiency. So, or actually, I don't think he had gotten boosted yet. And so, even so, if you're immunocompromised, you're going to have higher risk. And the thing is, when you go out to an event, to the store, whatever, you can't tell who those immunocompromised people are. They aren't wearing a sign or something. And the thing is that if we really want to protect our community and protect our fellow Idahoans, we all need to take these measures until we get the disease level down. We all need to get vaccinated. That's the way we take care of each other. And we have to realize that so much of this is because politics have entered into it, because we have for decades gotten vaccinations that for, go to school, to be in the military, to, you know, Dr. Burgess and I, every hospital and healthcare place we've ever worked, they've required vaccinations because they don't want us to transmit a disease to our patients. And those are just things that we have done. And without question, the fact that we're questioning it now with COVID is just a sign of how political this has gotten. But we have to remember that, yeah, you might be okay if you get COVID. And in fact, the person that infected this gentleman probably has no idea he or she was the one that infected him, but he lost his life. And so that's where we need to say, you know, let's come together as a community. We want to get back to a more normal life. The way for us to do that is let's all do our part.
This gentleman in the Idaho Capital Sun story was in the hospital with COVID, as I mentioned, for 3 weeks. And according to his wife, he seemed to be doing well before he suddenly got worse. Dr. Burgess, what happens when someone with COVID comes into your hospital? And I'm asking because we've heard and read stories about this, but can you walk us through what we would call a typical patient's journey when they have COVID and they go into the hospital?
Sure, Gemma. And unfortunately, we do see that. I remember reading this when we were first seeing COVID in the U.S. and at least in our part of the country, in Seattle. Obviously, they had a lot of COVID in New York, that it's kind of heartbreaking because people will be sick initially and then improve and then have a decline after that. So just when you kind of get your hopes up that they're turning the corner and you think, you know, this person's going to pull through, they'll get this secondary, you know, storm of inflammation that then they get more short of breath and they decline. So it's very challenging for obviously the patient, but also everyone taking care of them as well as their family. But really the steps that usually occur, a lot of people, as Dr. Pate said, have mild illness, either because they're healthy and young or because they've been vaccinated or they have some partial immunity from a prior infection. So the vast majority of people have mild illness and don't come to the hospital. But the folks that do, typically it's because they're short of breath. That's usually the presenting issue. They come in and their oxygen level is low. And so our initial treatment is oxygen and supporting them, you know, if they have a bad cough or if they have other symptoms, treating those symptoms, making sure they're comfortable. But really the prominent symptom is shortness of breath and low oxygen level. And then we have a variety of measurements that we look at in blood work, in looking at their imaging, their chest x-ray, their CT scans, to determine what other treatments they might need. So COVID has, as we've all learned, a variety of other complications like blood clotting and other inflammation of the heart. So sometimes we have to, you know, treat those issues as well, depending on what manifestations the patient's having. And then certain patients meet criteria for other medications that are available to try to reduce the inflammation, whether those are steroids or some of the newer medications, to try to keep that cytokine storm and other inflammatory reactions from becoming too severe. So that's how we start off. And then again, many people get better. Some people get well enough to go home. I would say most of my patients that have had COVID go home on oxygen for a while. Because of our, now we're a little better off, but because of our hospital bed issue, we were sending more people on home on a higher amount of oxygen than we used to. And we would be able to send them home with a way to monitor their oxygen level and have home health nurses check on them and, you know, make sure that they're okay. But then there are people that deteriorate and even despite our best efforts, start to get more short of breath and cannot respond even to the highest amount of oxygen that we can give them. And that's when they end up going to the intensive care unit and being on a ventilator and sometimes even requiring heroic measures such as ECMO, where we run their blood through a machine to increase the oxygen level. And some of those folks can be in the ICU for weeks and some will recover and some unfortunately do not. But that's kind of the sequence of events. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Dr. Pate, a question for you. Kristen Boise wrote in, what about flying during the Christmas season? Normally, I know we try to kind of stay away from these questions, Dr. Pate, because it's, right, assessing your own risk. But I think a lot of us have started to travel. It seemed fairly safe. And now we've got this new variant and we've got the holidays.
Yeah, well, it is a common question, and unfortunately, it's a very complicated answer. So the first is, what have you done to protect yourself? If you're not fully vaccinated, and if you don't have your booster, if you're eligible, then you're taking some risk. And I know that the airlines will tell us how safe the travel is, and as a general rule, that's true. However, I would just point out to people that we have had outbreaks on planes. And I think the most sobering thing to me was just probably about 10 days ago, if I remember correctly, there were two KLM flights that were going into New Amsterdam just as Omicron was being identified. Presumably, all of those passengers had had a negative test within the previous 2 days. Yet, when New Amsterdam stopped them and tested them, there were something like 631 passengers, and about 10% of them were positive for COVID. Wow. In fact, there was Omicron on the plane. So the point being that you cannot rely totally on the fact that people supposedly have been tested in the plane. I wouldn't get on a plane without wearing a very high quality mask and keeping that on for the flight. Also keep in mind, it's not just your flight that poses risk. How are you gonna get to the airport? Are you taking an Uber or something like that? That means you're gonna be in a car with somebody you don't know and who's been around a lot of people probably. In the airport, getting to and from your gate, being in the gate, you want to be very conscious of the fact that people could very well be sitting in that airport that are infected. So again, I would wear a very high quality mask if I was going to travel. The other concerns is you need to address where are you traveling to? If you're traveling to an area that is having very high disease activity, you know, right now, the Midwest, Northeast part of the country, then again, that's going to pose additional risk. And you also want to keep in mind, how are the hospitals there? Are they overwhelmed? Because remember, you could travel and yes, you might get COVID, might end up in the hospital. That'd be one issue. But other things happen to people too, and now you might need hospital services. Are they going to be there for you if you need them? The other issue is if it's international travel, you need to be very conscious about where you're going. We have this new emerging situation, and what happens is when there are big outbreaks, many countries choose at that time to implement some pretty big restrictions that could apply to you while you're there in that country. So you need to think about it. What would happen if we were traveling and there was a big outbreak and they did some kind of a lockdown? Do you have enough medication with you if you had to stay there an extra week or something? Could you afford to be away from work if you couldn't get back on time? Could you get medical care if you were there? And so there's just an awful lot of considerations to think about when you're thinking about travel.
Dr. Burgess, Barbara just wrote in and she asks, by telling the public Omicron is milder, could that be a deterrent to those not getting vaccinated?
You know, at this point, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of people have kind of, you know, entrenched in whatever their belief is about vaccination. Remember, Delta is not gone. You know, we were starting to see some decline in our positivity rate, but then it bumped up again a little bit after Thanksgiving, which is not surprising, as was mentioned about, you know, holiday gatherings. So right now I would get your original vaccine and then your booster for not just Omicron, but for the continued activity around Delta. So I don't think saying Omicron is mild is necessarily having a big impact on our vaccination rate, to be honest. I think we still have the same people that are willing to get vaccinated and the folks that are not, for whichever reasons.
Dr. Payne, I want to go back to what we just talked about in regards to flying. And it is because literally, as you were talking, we got a question in from Nancy. Her son and daughter-in-law are visiting. They haven't seen him in 2 years. They had a baby in July. The parents are vaccinated and boosted. The baby is being breastfed. You know, as well as I do, you cannot put a mask on a little baby. Grandma's very concerned. How can they keep the baby safe? She goes, I know for safety, my grandson cannot wear a mask. Is it too big of a risk right now for them to travel?
Well, you know, I do think that people have to make individualized risk decisions. How much risk are you willing to take? And, you know, that isn't necessarily a static answer. You might be willing to take greater risks under certain situations than perhaps other. For example, you know, maybe if it's a wedding, you decide, well, I'm willing to take more risk in order to be there, but maybe I wouldn't take as much risk and just decide to just take a, you know, trip and just go visit. Everybody's got to make their own risk decision. But I do think you have to consider that, again, we really don't have good information on this, but at least South Africa has been reporting a striking increase in percentage of children under two that they have hospitalized. So I don't know what that means yet. We're watching that. But I do think if you have a child that cannot be vaccinated at this time, I think you need to think twice. The way we protect children who are not vaccinated, not able to be vaccinated, is we surround them with people that are. You won't be doing that on an airplane or an airport. And you may not even be doing that depending on where you're going. And again, back to the point that I made earlier, you also, if you decide, you know, I am willing to take these risks because the reason for my travel is so important, then have a good plan. If you are going to out of state, if you or your child got sick, where would you go? What hospital, you know, research that. Where would you go? What hospital? What is their current capacity? Are they overwhelmed or could they handle it? Those are all things to consider, but you do have to realize that we get a little numb to these numbers because like just before this, I was talking to somebody who was saying, you know, our numbers in Idaho are so low. Well, they're not low. They're low in compare. It's relative. Yes, they're low compared to what we had, but we are still at levels that we haven't seen since last February. And so there's still a lot of disease transmission, and you need to factor all of this in your decisions. And as you and I have talked repeatedly about, Gemma, it's don't just use the risk of death and say, oh, well, the chance something severe would happen to my child is very low. No, you have to consider all of the other things. What is the risk of long-term problems and things that we don't really even know what those risks are to children that get infected? And you also need to consider who are you going to be around. If you're traveling, I bet it's to go see somebody. Is that somebody who is high risk? Is that somebody that if your child got infected, who might be fine, but do they end up, like you were pointing out in that article, are they going to go see grandpa and accidentally cause him to be exposed? So lots of considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Burgess, Barbara wrote in and she says, if we don't get the third world countries vaccinated, won't we continue to have variants develop? What should the United States do?
Well, there's some truth to that in the sense that we are a global community with travel the way it is. Something that happens across the world quickly travels, as we've seen with this pandemic. As far as what the United States should do, boy, that's above my level. That's a very, a significant political and funding question. I do strongly feel that had we done our due diligence and gotten ourselves vaccinated at much earlier, we may not have seen some of these variants develop, but that cat is now out of the bag. So we just have to do the best we can. But yes, it's true. We really need a high vaccination rate across the globe. But all we can, there's that saying about your circle of control and your circle of influence and what's outside of that. And what we can control is our own and our immediate family's behavior and risk taking. And I think that's where I would focus and hope that our government leaders and others will make good decisions on how to help make sure there's good access to vaccines around the world.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pate, Ingrid wrote in and she says, my family says that my husband and I are being too careful with our 16-month-old son. We know it's good for his development to socialize with other kids, but we have avoided public gatherings except for family get-togethers. So we don't go into public buildings with him. We're currently looking for childcare that requires teachers to wear masks. But my family says it's inevitable that he will get COVID. And until then, we are not helping to boost his immune system because he is not in contact with other kids. Since we don't know when he will be eligible for a vaccine, we want to reduce risk as much as possible. So what really is the best practice for parents with infants? And Dr. Pate, I am so thankful that I don't have babies now because they can't mask. And I mean, I was a hot mess enough before my youngest could get vaccinated. So
I can believe that. Yeah. Well, Gemma, first of all, let me applaud the mother and father of this child. They're doing the right thing. The parents which would be the grandparents of the child, I would take issue with what they're saying in two particular points. First of all, I do believe it's our job as parents to protect our children. We can't protect them from everything, but we need to protect them for things that we can. And this child will eventually be able to get vaccinated. It's probably not going to be until the early part of next year, but this child will be able to get vaccinated. So here's the two things that I would take exception with. Number one, the point that the child it's just a matter of certainty the child is going to get infected. I would say that's true if the parents were not willing or going to get the child vaccinated. But we do know that the vaccines work. And so if they are going to get this child eventually vaccinated when that is authorized, then the thing to do is, you know, and we're talking several months or so, is you continue to protect that child until that child can get vaccinated. Now, the second thing is that somehow this child, you know, is going to not have immune development of their system because they're not getting exposed to other children. It is true that getting exposed to different things does build our immune system. However, that child's immune system is developing right now. It doesn't have to be that the child is getting exposed to things from another child. The child is getting exposed to things that we all are in our environment, and that will develop this child's immune system. And then once the child is eligible to be vaccinated and gets vaccinated, and by the way, during this time, the child should be getting all the other normally required vaccinations, that's going to be plenty to develop this child's immune system. The other thing is, getting COVID is not a good way to develop your immune system. We see, and Dr. Burgess sees this all the time, people who get COVID, and it actually wreaks havoc on their immune system. So I want to say that mom and dad are doing the right thing. Hang in there. It's just a matter of a few more months, and I applaud them.
Dr. Burgess, a listener from Blaine County wrote in saying that they got COVID in March of 2020. They were asymptomatic, except she says they lost smell until fall of 2021. And I still don't have it completely back. I just started smelling coffee in September. So I'm interested in learning more about long COVID. So what do we know at this point in regards to long COVID?
Well, you know, like a lot of things with COVID, we are still learning. And, you know, fortunately, most people have mild illness and recover completely. But we are seeing, you know, obviously that what we've been talking about, people that are hospitalized and even die from COVID. But then there's this other group of people that Dr. Pate alluded to that have other long-term effects. And that's, you know, the group of long COVID. And losing your sense of taste and smell might seem minor, but I have patients that have had that for 7 months or more. And sounds pretty miserable, you know, to not be able to taste or smell how much that would affect, you know, your quality of life. But there are other things, too, that are even more concerning, such as fatigue, heart issues, inflammation around the heart, difficulty with what people call brain fog, where they just can't seem to think as clearly as they used to, even some body aches and that type of thing. I think, you know, down the road, we'll understand more why some people are affected differently than others, why some people get so sick and die, and why other people have mild illness, and then these other people seem to have these long-term effects. I do think, you know, like I said, we're still learning. A lot of times we have different specialists kind of follow depending on what the particular issue is. My hope is that these folks will eventually completely recover, but I don't yet confidently know. I will say most of my patients, anywhere from a few weeks to, like I said, up to 7 months or so, are starting to get back their sense of taste and smell, and many of the other side effects and symptoms are starting to improve. So that's my hope, is that they will eventually improve.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Burgess, does St. Alphonsus offer any support groups or anything like that for folks who have experienced long COVID or are experiencing it?
You know, we had a COVID clinic for quite some time that we were running to treat folks. And it became to the point where it really made more sense to have that cared for in our regular clinic. So we don't have a specific clinic geared to that anymore. And as far as actual support groups, I don't think we have anything set up specifically for that. Mm. But we certainly have incorporated that into our overall care because it has become common enough that we all are, you know, reading and learning how to best support folks that are having these problems.
Yeah. Dr. Burgess, we had a listener write in saying that they were vaccinated back in April, had a mild breakthrough case of COVID in September. So now they're wondering, when would it be appropriate to get a booster shot?
So, you know, early in the pandemic, we were having people wait up to 90 days to get a vaccine after they had had COVID, but that's no longer the recommendation. So once you've recovered from your infection enough to be released from quarantine, which is usually somewhere in that 10 to 14 day range, you know, 10 days past your positive test, but you have to also have improvement of your symptoms over a 48 hour period with no using fever reducing agents. So once you've cleared quarantine, then you really are eligible to get vaccinated. And then the booster is 6 months after your second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or 2 months after your dose of Johnson & Johnson. So that would be, those would be the different criteria.
Dr. Pate, Penelope wrote in, she says a family member, 6-year-old child was exposed to lead in the drinking water in Bellevue for at least the last 5 weeks before being notified. Her mother is now hesitating to vaccinate her because she is suffering all of the classic symptoms of lead poisoning. She feels that the little one's body is just under too much duress. And the mom says, quote, her body right now is dealing with a lot and I need to get this straightened out first. I am asking you for feedback on whether it is safe for her to be vaccinated right now.
So, you know, we have to, you know, I hear a lot of situations like this. And I think as the parent, what you have to balance is, again, not just, well, what would the risk of vaccination be, but you need to balance what would the risk of COVID be, because as however stressful mom thinks that vaccine might be, let me assure you, COVID is far more stressful on the child. Now, this is going to be one of those cases where mom just needs to really have a conversation with the pediatrician about her child's specific case. But lead poisoning, a couple of things. One, typically it's not going to impact your immune system. It causes a whole lot of other potential problems, but typically not the immune system. So I don't know off the top of my head any reason that the child should not be vaccinated. But again, talk to the pediatrician. And the other thing is lead poisoning is generally something that takes a very long time for the body to kind of get cleared of. And so really mom needs to think about, you know, what are going to be the risks to my child if I don't get vaccinated? If mom's in a situation where mom can stay home, mom takes care of the child's not coming around a lot of other children, and the mom wants to wait to get vaccinated, that's fine because the child's not going to have a risk of getting infected if mom and baby or infant don't get out. But on the other hand, if that child goes to daycare, if that child is moved between families, going to be around other people that are exposure risk, I think she should think twice about not getting that child protected. So have a talk with the pediatrician about the specifics, because lead poisoning can present itself in a whole lot of different ways, but there's nothing that comes to my mind that would say we absolutely shouldn't vaccinate the child right now. So talk to the pediatrician.
Dr. Burgess, Ann wrote in asking, what if anything is known about the health conditions of people experiencing breakthrough infections?
The health conditions, like if they have other,
I would assume they're wanting to.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have those statistics, at the top of my head. We do know that people like the poor gentleman that you mentioned in the article that are immunocompromised, or I think when I read the article, he was on a medication that modulates your immune system for rheumatoid arthritis. And so we know people that are on certain medications or have certain conditions are at both risk to not respond as well to the vaccine and also at risk to have COVID. So it would make sense that those might be more likely to have breakthrough cases, but I don't have, you know, the actual statistics on that. What I do know is those breakthrough cases tend to be mild And we are not seeing, we're seeing very few of those folks in the hospital and certainly in the ICU or dying. And those small percentage, I know we've said this before on the show, that it's about 98% of the people in the hospital that are in the ICU in particular that are unvaccinated. We are seeing that 1-2% that are vaccinated tend to be folks that are over the age of 65 or have some kind of a additional chronic health condition. So the people that get severely ill, I would say, tend to have other health conditions.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pate, kind of a disinformation question coming in. Don writes in, they have a neighbor who says that the vaccines do not prevent COVID. How do we convince them otherwise? I don't know if these days you can.
Yeah, that is a good question. I certainly have many discussions with many people that are just absolutely convinced of things that are misinformation, including in my own family. I think my general approach is starting out by saying, well, why do you say that? And try to understand, where has the person gotten this information and what was the person told? And I think probably the clearest point that I could just show this person the data, look at our elderly. So, and I just want to give a shout out to Dr. Burgess for her work on the Idaho Vaccine Committee. Really, really, really tough work, but they made a lot of decisions about prioritizing this vaccine that in retrospect were really great decisions. And one of those was to get our elderly and high-risk people prioritized for vaccination. And what you can do is just look at what has happened to the numbers of our over 65 who have gotten infected, gotten hospitalized, and who have died. Those numbers have plummeted since the vaccine was available. That's our highest risk group. As Dr. Burgess said earlier, there just cannot be any argument that these vaccines protect you. They do. Now, they don't protect 100%, and they don't protect 100% of people, but they do protect. So find out where the information is coming from and then show them the data.
As always, I want to thank both of you for taking time to talk to us, to give us scientific, fact-based information, especially since we continue to have disinformation out there. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Patrice Burgess, who is the chair of the Governor's Vaccine Advisory Task Force, as well as the Executive Medical Director at St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you, guys.
And I want to thank all of you for being here with us today. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.